I would like, if I may, talk over something which seems to me extraordinarily important. I think a group, a community or a society that has not understood the problem of time, death and love will obviously be very superficial. And a society or a community that is superficial must inevitably deteriorate. I mean by that word superficial merely to be contented with outward phenomena, with outward success, with prosperity, having a good time, and demanding entertainment. And such a society, or human beings who are part of that society, must inevitably deteriorate, whether they go to a church or to a football, or just the same, because they need to be entertained, stimulated. And unless we human beings resolve these fundamental questions, inevitably the mind will deteriorate. And the problem is it possible to stop this continuous wave of deterioration? Not only of the mind and the heart, but also the deterioration that takes place when there is not earnestness, an urgency, a passion. And when we are going to talk over together this question of time, death and so on, I think it is important to bear in mind that the word, the explanation, is not the fact. And most of us are so easily satisfied with explanations. We think we have understood it. If you are clever enough to explain anything away, as most of us are who have read a great deal or who have experimented with many things, we can give explanation to almost anything. And the explanation seems to satisfy most of us. But when we are going to discuss something very seriously, mere satisfaction of verbal explanation seems to me so utterly futile, so immature, And so, if I may go over it again a little briefly, it is very important how one listens. Because most of us do not listen at all. We listen either with pleasure or with distaste or with a formula of ideas, a philosophy which we have cultivated or have learned. Through these screens we listen, interpreting, translating, putting aside what we like and what we don't like, keeping what we like, rather. And so, the act of listening never takes place. I do not know if you have ever observed, if you are listening to somebody whom you have known for many years, fairly intimate. You hardly listen. You already know what they are going to say. Your mind is already made up. You have already certain conclusions, certain images, which prevent actual listening. And to listen is an extraordinarily important act. Because I feel if one could listen not only to what is being said on this, from the speaker, but also listen to everything about our life every day. Listen to all the various noises. Listen to the incessant chatter of one's friend or one's wife or husband. Or the rumblings of one's own mind, this soliloquy that goes on. Neither condemning nor justifying, but actually listening. Then that listening brings about in itself an action. An action which is totally different from the action of a very calculated, drilled thought. So, perhaps this evening we could so listen, which doesn't mean that you must agree or disagree. On the contrary, the mind must be, to listen, must be extraordinarily sensitive. Must be eager, critical, aware of its own functioning. Which means it is in a state of attention, therefore of passion. It's only such a mind that can listen actually and go beyond the verbal images and conclusions, hopes, fears and all the rest of it. Then only is there communication between two people, which is actually what is, if one may use that word which is so heavily laden and spoilt, love. And I hope we can establish that relationship between the speaker and yourself so that we can discuss informally this question of time and of death. I do not know if you have ever gone into this question of death. Most of us are afraid of this thing called death, which is unknown. On the contrary, we avoid it. We put it away. Or we have come to certain conclusion, rationalize death, and are satisfied to live the allotted time. But to understand something of which we don't know, there must be obviously the end of fear. And to understand fear, not the explanation of fear, not all the psychological structure of fear, the nature of fear, which if we have time this evening we can go into briefly, unless this question is totally resolved. Neither suppressing nor escaping from it. We cannot possibly understand the nature of death. So our first concern, it seems to me, when we are dealing with deep subjects, deep realities, we must approach it with a fresh mind. With a mind that is not neither hoping nor despair. A mind that is capable of observing, facing fact, without any sense of tremor, fear, anxiety. So, one has, I think, to totally understand this problem of fear. Whether the mind can be completely be free of fear entirely. Because a mind that is afraid, that is in despair, or has the fantasy of hope, which is always looking to the future, such a mind is a clouded mind. Is a confused mind. It is incapable of thinking clearly, except along its trained, drilled technological knowledge. It will function mechanically there. But a mind that's afraid lives in darkness. A mind that's confused. In despair, in anxiety, cannot resolve anything apart from the mechanical process of existence. And I'm afraid most of us are satisfied to live mechanically. We'd rather not deal with deeper subjects, deeper issues, deeper challenges. So, is it possible to be free in the whole area of the mind? What is called the unconscious as well as in the conscious. As we said the other day, there is no such thing as the unconscious. There is only this field of consciousness. One can be aware of a particular area of the field and not be aware of the rest of it. If you are not aware of the rest of it, then you don't understand this whole area. Unfortunately, it has been divided into the conscious and the unconscious. And we play this game between the conscious and the unconscious all the time. And it becomes the fashion to inquire into the unconscious. Whereas if one is at all aware of the whole field, there's no need for the unconscious at all. And therefore, there is no need for dreams. It's only the mind that is aware of a particular field, a particular corner of the field, and totally unaware of the rest. Then it begins to dream. And there are all the interpretations of dream and all that stuff. Whereas if one aware during the entire day of every thought, every feeling, every motive, every response, aware, not interpreting, not condemning, not judging it, but just to be aware of the whole process, then you will say, there is no need for dreams at all. Then the mind becomes highly sensitive, active, not made dull. And when we inquire into this question of fear, when we examine it, and I hope we'll do it together this evening, we have to cover the whole area, the whole field. Not one particular form of fear. Not your particular favorite fear. Or the fear which you are avoiding. Fear, surely, exists only in relationship to something. It doesn't exist by itself. I'm afraid of you. I'm afraid of an idea. I'm afraid of my belief will be shattered because of a new idea, and so on and so on. It's in relation to something. It doesn't exist per se, by itself. And to understand the total fear, one must look at it non-fragmentarily. Not as a particular neurotic fear that one has. One must look at it as you look at the total map of the world. Then you can go to the particular. Then you can take in detail and look at the particular road, the particular village you're going to, and so on, so on, so on. One must have the total comprehension. And that's somewhat arduous, because we always think in terms of the particular, in terms we think in fragments. So, to come into contact fear, the total fear, requires total attention. I mean by that word attention, not concentration. Concentration is the easiest thing to do. But to attend demands your complete energy. You must, to attend, to give your complete attention, your body, your mind, your heart, your nerves, everything must be at its highest point. And then there is only attention. Then you can, with that attention, you look at fear. Then in that attention, there is no fragmentary, broken concentration on a particular subject. You see the whole of it. And it's only when one sees the totality of fear with its structure, meaning, its inwardness of it, then you will see, if you go that far, you will see fear comes to an end, completely. Because you're not caught by the word, by the symbol, by the word fear, which creates fear also. The word creates its own fear. Like the word death creates its own fear. And when one becomes attentive, when the problem is urgent, when the challenge is immediate and you feel that challenge instantly, come into contact completely with that challenge, one is never in contact. With a problem, with a challenge, with an issue. Because when an issue arises, we have already an answer for it. We already have a conclusion, a verbal cunning mind that meets that word and is already, or that challenge is already answered, that challenge. So there is never any contact. To be in contact means to be directly in touch with something. And you cannot come into touch with something directly if there is an idea between. So, to come into contact with fear, to come into contact with fear, one has not only to understand the world which stimulates fear, and therefore understand how the mind is caught in worlds. Which is all our thinking is formulated in words, in symbols. And so, to come directly into contact with fear, the verbal structure which the brain, the mind has created, one must be free of that word, of the structure. If I want to come into contact with that, I have to touch it. But the touch is not the word, is not a conclusion, it's an actual fact. And the more one is cunning, clever, erudite, full of knowledge and rash intellection, then you don't touch at all. These ideas touch that. There's no direct contact with it. So, if one listens to what is being said in that direct sense, then you will discover the total area of the mind, because it's understood the nature of the world, how the world creates the feeling, the image foreshadows what it is afraid of, and so on, so on, so on. So the verbal, the symbolic, the process of thinking in terms of word has come to an end, and therefore you are able to come directly into contact with that thing which one calls fear. You see, as we were saying the other day, we are never in contact with any other human being, your wife or with your husband or your children or with whoever it is, because we have images of the husband or the wife or the boss and so on. These images have relationship between each other. And so actually there is no relationship at all. And these images are everlastingly in battle with each other. And so we have images about fear, about death, about love, and so all the deeper issues of life. And to understand the question of time is very important. I'm using the word understand in the sense come directly into contact with some things which the mind through thought cannot possibly comprehend. You cannot comprehend love through words, through ideas, through your experiences which you had. So, to go into this question of time is important, because to understand death you must understand time. And to understand death and time is to understand what love is. And without understanding these three things, fundamental issues of life, life has very little meaning. You may go to the office, have plenty of money and, you know, all that stuff. There's very little meaning, actually. And hence, when life loses its deep significance, then you are satisfied with superficial activity which leads more to more confusion, to more sorrow. And that's what is actually taking place in the world. Not only in this country, but the whole Europe and India and so on. So these questions, as a human being, must be solved. Because a human being is part of society. Human being is not separate from society. He's part of it. He's conditioned by society, which he has created. And to create a new society or a new community, the fundamental issues of life must be solved. When we are talking about time, we do not mean the chronological time, time by the watch. That time exists, must exist. If you want to catch a bus, if you want to go to a train and so on, or an appointment, you must have the time tomorrow. But is there a tomorrow psychologically, which is the time of the mind? Is there psychologically tomorrow, actually? Or the tomorrow is created by thought? Because thought sees the impossibility of change directly, immediately, and invents this process of gradualness. That is, I see for myself as a human being, it's terribly important to bring about a radical revolution in my way of life, thinking, feeling, in my action. And I say to myself, I'll take time over it. Time being, what I am today, I will be different tomorrow, or a month's time, and so on, so on. That is the time we're talking about. The psychological structure of time, of tomorrow, or the future, and in that time we live, it is. Time is the past, the present, and the future. not by the watch. I was yesterday operates through today, creates the future. That's a fairly simple thing. I have had an experience a year ago that has left an imprint on my mind, and the present I translate according to that experience, knowledge, tradition, conditioning, and I create the tomorrow. So I'm caught in this circle. This is what we call living, what we call time. Please, I hope you're observing your own minds and not listening merely to the speaker. And in this process of time, memory is very important. Memory of a happy childhood, memory of some deep experience, memory of a pleasure which I've stored up, which I want to repeat it tomorrow. And the repetition of that pleasure tomorrow is continued through thought. So, thought is time. Because if I didn't think psychologically of tomorrow, there is no tomorrow. Please, it is not oversimplification to understand something very complex that needs deep examination and penetration. You must begin very, very simply. And it is first step that matters, not the last step. So, thought, which is you, with all its memories, conditioning, ideas, hopes, despair, the utter loneliness of existence, all that is this time. The brain is the result of time, chronologically. 2 million years and more. It has its own reactions of greed, envy, ambition, jealousy, anxiety. And to understand a timeless state, when time has come to a stop, one must inquire whether the mind can be free totally of all experience, which is of time. All right, can I go on? I hope I'm not making it complicated, am I? Explanations are complicated, but not the actual fact. And if one is aware, however little bit attentive, one sees this process. Life is a continuous process of challenge and response. And every response is conditioned by its past responses, memories. And every challenge is new. In other words, it's not a challenge. And we're always responding from the past. Except on rare occasions that which we didn't discuss here. They're so rare, there's so much matter. And into this brain, every challenge and response as experience is being accumulated. And from that accumulation we act, we think, we feel, we function psychologically, inwardly, inside the skin as it were. And that is time. So one asks oneself whether it is possible to live so completely that there is neither tomorrow, yesterday or today or tomorrow. And that to understand that and live it, not theoretically but actually, one must examine the structure of memory, of thought, and as one has to ask oneself, what is thinking at all? What is thinking? And why should we think? I know it's the habit to think, to reason, to judge, to choose. To judge, to choose, to think at a mechanical level is absolutely necessary. Otherwise we couldn't function. So, is it possible to live from day to day freed from the psychological time as yesterday, today and tomorrow? Which doesn't mean that you live in the moment. That's one of our absurd fallacies. That what matters is to live now. The now is the result of yesterday. What you have thought, what you have felt, your memories, your anxieties, hopes, fears, all that have been stored up. Unless one understands that and dissipates it, you can't live in the now. Therefore, there is no such thing as the now. Pradana, for life is a movement, endless movement. Which movement we have divided psychologically as yesterday, today and tomorrow. And hence we have invented the gradual process of achievement, of freeing oneself. You know, it's like a man who smokes or drinks. He'll give it up gradually. He'll take time over it. It's like a man who is violent and has the ideal of non-violence. He's pursuing non-violence and sowing seeds of violence in the meantime. That's what we are actually are doing, which is called evolution. I'm not a fundamentalist, please. So, the mind which has the mind, the brain, the whole structure can only understand a state of mind which has no time at all, only when we have understood for ourselves the nature of memory and thought. Then we can begin to understand the nature of death. Because death now is something in the distance, over there. We turn our back on it. We run away from it. We have theories about it. We rationalize it. Or we have hopes beyond it, which is in Asia, in India, they believe in reincarnation. And that's a hope, which doesn't mean that one has understood the whole beauty of death. I'm not being sentimental. The speaker is not being sentimental about death when he uses the word beauty. The issue involved in a future life is that there is a permanent entity as the soul, as something which continues. And they have given various names to that in the East and in the West, but in essence it is the same thing, something permanent, something that has a continuity. And there is the death of the physical, the organism, wearing itself out through strain, stresses, through various misuses, drugs, overindulgence of everything. So the mechanism gradually wears out, dies. That's an obvious fact. But hope comes in and says, there is a continuity. It is the end of everything. I have lived, struggled, accumulated, learned, developed a character. I don't know why one develops a character, which is neither here nor there. Character is merely a resistance. And that permanent entity will continue till it becomes perfect, whatever that may mean. So, is there a permanent entity at all? I know the believers, but the believers are not the speakers of truth. They are merely dogmatists, theologians, or people who are full of fanciful hope. So, if you examine yourself to find out if there is a thing that's permanent, obviously there is nothing permanent, both outwardly and inwardly. Though each one of us craves for security outwardly, we are denying it by our nationalities, by wars. They are denying security, total physical security in Vietnam. Though each of them crave for security. And is there such thing as permanent security, except an idea about it? If there is not, and there is no such thing as there is, then what is it that continues? Memory? Experiences which are dead ashes of things that have been? And if you do, as so many people believe in reincarnation, different forms as a resurrection, all the rest of it, if you do, then it matters tremendously how you live today. What you believe today, how you act, what everything matters immensely what you do now. Because in next life you're going to pay for it. So it's just an avoidance of the real fact of what death is. There is the death of the physical organism. And to find out what death is beyond that, can the whole psyche, with all the tendencies, pleasures, idiosyncrasies, memories, experiences die each day completely without argument, without restraint, die. Have you ever tried to die to a pleasure? Something that you want tremendously, that gives you great satisfaction, delight, without any reason, without any motive, without any argument, to die to it. If you can, you know what death means. To empty the mind totally of everything of the past. And it can be done, it should. That's the only way to live. After all, love is that, isn't it? Love is not thought. Love is not desire, pleasure. Pleasure, desire, continues through thought. And when thought thinks about a particular pleasure, sexual or otherwise, then it ceases to be love. It's an appetite. An appetite has its own place. But we unfortunately talk a great deal about love. The churches, the books, the cinemas. If one loved, there'd be no war. You'd educate your children entirely differently. Not merely condition them to certain technological knowledge. Then the whole world won't be mad about this thing called sex, as though they've discovered something totally new. And we only know love as a sexual appetite, with its lusts and demands and frustrations and despairs, jealousies, and all the travail of human mind in what is called love. So love has nothing whatsoever to do with the formula of thought. And that comes into being only when memory as thought with all its demands and pleasures comes to an end, psychologically. Then love is something entirely different. You cannot talk about it. You cannot write everlasting books about it. Love of God and love of man, this division doesn't exist. But to come to that, one must not only be free from fear, but also there must be a time ending. Therefore, understanding life, you can only understand life when you understand death. The thing that we call living is this anxiety, this despair, this sense of guilt, the endless longing, the utter loneliness, boredom. This is what we call living. Constant conflict, conflict. A battlefield. The world of business, in our daily existence at home, in the battlefields all over the world, destroying each other. This is what we call living. And actually it is a frightful mess, a deadly affair. And when that so-called living comes to an end, and it can only come to an end when one dies to the whole of it, not partial, to certain fragments of it. Then one lives. So death and living go together. And for death and life to continue together, there must be dying every day to everything. Then the mind is made fresh, young, innocent. And that innocence cannot come through any drug, through any experience. It must be beyond and above all experience. A light to itself does not need any experience. In a way, talk over together in detail by asking questions about all this. It's better.
Why were we put here?
Huh? Come on.
Why are we alive?
Why are we alive?
Why are we put here? Why are we put here as a person?
Why are we put here on this earth? Who has put you? Surely that is. Please. As we said the other day, don't let's ask irrelevant questions. What is relevant is how to live, not why you are put here. Obviously, you know how we have come into being. Father, mother. But we are here. And we are dying slowly or rapidly, deteriorating with our prosperity, with our self-centered activities. And is it possible to live in this world, not in a monastery, isolating oneself, or isolating oneself in some conclusions, beliefs and dogmas, or in some nationality, or in good works? But can one live? That's the real issue. I wish we could discuss that. Yes, sir. How does one die each day? Is there a method? If there is a method, then the method produces its own end. Surely. If I follow a particular method, you told me how to die every day, a method, step by step. What happens? Do I die actually, or am I practicing certain method to die? And please, this is very important to understand this. The means is the end. The two are not separate. If the means is mechanical, the end is mechanical. If the means is a way of assuring pleasure, gain, profit and all the rest of it, then the end is also that. So the means creates its own end. And one has to completely deny that mean. Oh, the total means, which is time. So there is no how to die. You understand, this sounds rather silly. Let me, à l'instant, je prie. So, look. You have a certain habit. Sexual. Certain habit of drinking, smoking, talking, mannerisms, temperaments. Can you die? Can you completely put it away on the instant? Smoking, drinking, pleasure. I know that there are the methods of how to give up smoking, little by little, one by one, you know. But that's not, you don't give, there is no ending to that. Ending means finishing, completely ending. And that does take place when death actually comes. You don't argue with it. Second one, live so completely each day, each minute, so that there is no yesterday or tomorrow. So to do this requires a great deal of meditation and inward awareness. It's not a matter of agreeing or disagreeing or asking how is it to be done. Nobody is going to tell you whether you have or have not. So this demands a great deal of energy and insight and understanding and awareness. And highest quality of sensitivity, which is intelligence. After all, the drugs, LSDs and all the rest of it, makes one, not that I've taken them, makes one sensitive in a particular corner of that vast field of life. In the rest of the field, one is insensitive, dull. And because one becomes highly sensitive in a particular area, seeing colors, visions, experience, and all the rest of you think that's the whole of substance of life. But to understand the totality of life, one must be totally sensitive, both physiologically and psychologically. You think one thinks one can be highly psychologically sensitive, but physically brutal, heavy, insensitive. Life is not to be divided into fragments and each fragment in conflict with the other. We only know this conflict. This endless effort till we die. In the family, in the office, in the quiet moments of our life. There is never a moment of silence, a state without effort.
the other day who said, if a man dying in Vietnam is you, would you speak further on this?
The questioner says, the man dying in Vietnam is you. Please go into a little more. Madame, nous parlons. Ah, we are not talking of the man dying in Vietnam. We are talking of the man living here now. The man dying in Vietnam is the result of our life. We do not want peace. We talk about it endlessly. And to have peace, we must live peacefully. That means no competition, no ambition, no division, as nationalities, color, prejudice. You understand what it means? If you want to, what it means to live peacefully? And as we don't live peacefully, we have wars in Vietnam, in India, in Russia, you know, all the rest of it. Really, we educate our children to die, to be killed, whether in the office, in the family, or in the battlefield. And this we call living. And we are supposed to be highly civilized, sophisticated people. Too bad. So sorrow is the lot of us. And to end sorrow, one must end time. One must understand this nature of death. And where there is love, there is no sorrow. Sorrow for the neighbor, or for somebody beside you or ahead of you. Where there is love, there is an ending of sorrow, not the worshipping of sorrow. Krishna says if we are not to make effort, then it's a mere accident.
An accident, if anything, is understood.
Of anything, of course. So, why do we make effort? First, let's understand it. Not if we are not to make effort. We are making effort. From the moment we are born till we die, effort, struggle. What for? Why? Again, psychologically, inwardly. Which if I understand rightly, then outwardly it'll have a totally different meaning, this struggle, existence. So one must understand effort. This constant striving. What for? Why? There is effort when there is contradiction. There is effort when there is comparison. You are better than I, you are much more clever, you have better position, you are famous, and so on, so on, so on. And I am nobody. I am So I must treat you. That's a fact, not a supposition. This is how we function every day of our life. We worship success. Every magazine is filled with success. And from moment of one goes to school till we die, we are comparing, struggling, in incessant conflict, because there is a division, a contradiction between the one who compares and that which is compared to. Through comparison we think we understand, actually we don't. And it's to live without comparison requires tremendous intelligence and sensitivity. Because then there is no example. There is no something as should be the ideal, the hero, the example. One begins with what actually is. And to understand what is, there is no need for comparison. And when you compare, you destroy what is. You don't understand actually what is. It's like comparing a boy to his elder brother, who is very clever. And so you destroy the younger boy. And that's what we are doing all the time. And we are struggling. Struggling for what psychologically? To end violence? To have more pleasure? To have more experiences? To end violence is to come directly into contact with it, in yourself. And you cannot come into contact with it if there is an ideal as non-violence, peace and all the rest of it. This opposite creates the conflict. But if you can look at that violence completely, with total attention, then there is no conflict, striving. It comes to an end. It is this absurd, idiotic ideals that destroy this direct contact with reality. And one can live a life without conflict. Which doesn't mean you become a vegetable. On the contrary, the mind becomes highly aware, intelligent, full of energy, passion. And it's the man in conflict that dissipates this intelligence. Come on, Mela. Is there any difference between love and understanding? One word will cover everything. But the danger of one word is that it becomes a jargon. You can use the word love, understanding, but it really doesn't matter which word you use. because every word is loaded. Like God, death, experience, love, heavy with meaning, what people have given to that word. But when one realizes the word love is not the actual state, then the word doesn't matter at all.
Technology is so advanced and the world is so populated that I wonder how can we exist without community and politics and therefore participation in direction of the community.
How can one live in this world when it's so overpopulated, technology is so advanced, without the help of the politician?
No, without participating.
Without participating in politics, in communal activities and so on, so on, so on. There is only one political problem, only one, which is the unity of mankind. And you cannot have the unity of mankind if there are nationalities, if there are armies, if there is not one government. Neither democratic nor republican nor labor. And when we are concerned with human beings, whether they live in Russia, in India, in China or here, we have the means of feeding, sheltering, clothing people now. But we don't do it because you know all the reasons. Our nationalities, our religious prejudices, all the rest of it. So,
is not technical knowledge and psychological knowledge tied together? Can they be separated?
Yes, sir, we said that. But, sir, just a minute. You see, so this is a tremendously important point, isn't it? How is a human being living in this utter chaos? How can he live supremely intelligently? So that he is both a good citizen, not in a particular community, I'm talking of in the world. The world is not America or Russia or India. How can he live in this world with such chaos, misery around him? That is the issue. Should he join the Communist Party, the Democratic Party or some other party? Because there must be action. How shall we act together? Which end shall we begin? From the technological end or from a totally different end? From an end which is not of time, which is not of class, which is not of any experience. If we can come to grips with that, then we shall solve all our problems.
What's the name?
Huh?
What is the name?
What is the?
What is the name? Give us the name.
What is the name of the other? Is that it?
Yes.
Do you think, sir, a name will be really satisfactory? Call it X, call it God, call it love, any name. The name is not the real. Will that naming it be sufficient? Huh? thousands of people have named it.
He was the foreman.
He wants a formula. No, Dasya. We have talked about formulas, an ideology. A community based on an ideology is no longer a community. They battle each other for position, prestige in that community. We are talking of something entirely different. We said a new mind is necessary, not a new technique, a new method, a new philosophy, a new drug, a new mind. And that new mind cannot come into being unless there is a dying to the old completely. Emptying the mind totally of the past. Then you don't want a name. Then you are living it. Then you will know what bliss is. It's only the innocent mind living in this world with all the chaos around it. It's only the innocent mind that can answer these problems, not the complicated mind.